If you're listening to this podcast, you're surely aware of the shots that LSU women's basketball coach Kim Mulkey has taken at the Washington Post and newspaper's tremendous sports writer, Kent Babb. In particular, there was this, said last week in the lead up to the first round of March Madness.
This reporter has been working on a story about me for 2 years. After 2 years of trying to get me to sit with him for an interview, he contacts LSU on Tuesday as we were getting ready for the first round game of this tournament with more than a dozen questions, demanding a response by Thursday, right before we're scheduled to tip off. Are you kidding me? This was a ridiculous deadline that LSU and I could not possibly meet, and the reporter knew it. It was just an attempt to prevent me from commenting and an attempt to distract us from this tournament. It ain't gonna work, buddy.
And to Kim Mulkey, loyal listener of Two Writers Slaying Yang, I say you are 100% right. You nailed it. Yep. How dare the Washington Post only give you 2 years to comment? How dare they send you a list of questions? And clearly, the greatest concern in the Washington Post newsroom isn't Decision 24 or the Gaza Strip or the inner workings of the nation's capital. Nope, it's LSU's first-round game against Rice. You nailed it, buddy. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Sarah D. Bunting, one of the interweb's most prolific, and I'm going old school here, bloggers, the founder of Tomato Nation and Television Without Pity, a writer for Reality Blurred, and a woman who shit all over my book about the 1986 Mets. This is episode number 357. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
Sarah Bunting, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. And we were just talking off the air, and I want to ask you first, I initially recontacted you, I guess, recently because I wrote something and I referenced a review of a book I wrote in 2009 mm-hmm. called The Rocket That Fell to Earth about Roger Clemens.
Right.
And on your website, Tomato Nation, there is a review that tore the book apart, absolutely tore the book apart. And yep. I always thought you had written it, but it was just someone who read your website and submitted the review. However, so I was like, all right, Sarah's off the hook. However, here's the intro to that review written by you, Sarah. I just want to say,
okay.
Tomato Nation 2009. The other day I received an email from reader Todd K in which he crabbed at length about Jeff Perlman's new book on Roger Clemens. I just read in Sports Illustrated's baseball preview that the book is well-written. A claim I greeted with an out loud, I doubt it. Given how much I hated the writing in Perlman's book about the 86 Mets. Mm. And then you ran Todd's review and he clearly hated my Clemens book even more than you hated my New York 86 Mets book. And Sarah, I just want to start this by saying, because you asked me if I concur. So I just want to start by saying, go fuck yourself.
Mm. Fair. I'll take that.
Yeah. Actually, I do want to start with this. I'm interested because you have spent a lot of your life and your career analyzing, talking about, writing about pop culture, writing about TV, writing about books, writing about movies, and you've criticized a lot of it. In the course of your career, do you just have to not worry about how the people who create it feel about what you write? Like, can you not consider, some 20 whatever year old writer wrote this book, put his heart into it, he's going to read this and feel really bad. Is that just non-factor?
I mean, in the beginning, absolutely, that was non-factor. Now, and I think I said this in a comment on your Substack, that I read some quote from Vince Gilligan, who has worked on a lot of legendary TV and, of course, is the creator of Breaking Bad, Better Call Saul, two of my all-timers, TV-wise. I actually read this quote in a book about Breaking Bad that I thought was quite bad and was planning to savage it in my review. And he said, even the worst hour of television that you ever saw was miserably hard to make. I may be misquoting him slightly, but that was the gist. that was like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. And that has stuck with me ever since, that you have to be, I think you have to be fair, or as fair as you can be. Not like, oh, you know, poor kid, like, let's spare everybody's feelings, but like, let's look at the book for what it is, what it's trying to do, and not be that person who is, I don't know. It's like when the Transformer movies were out and people are like, Megan Fox as an actress has a great butt. And it's like, if you want Meryl Streep, go to a Meryl Streep movie. She's made a bunch. She's good in most of them. But don't ask Megan Fox, who's acting against a robot that the computer hasn't even made yet, to be Meryl Streep. That's not fair. I have tried, as my career has gone on, to be a little, fairer, and also to not be in my 20s and kind of putting, getting a good line off before everything else, which, you know, that's how I started. That's how I came up. That's what blogging was like. I don't think I was any worse than anybody else, but I'm certainly not going to be doing things the same as I was doing them at the turn of the millennium, because, you know, I'm just not. So your response to that review is not out of line, I wouldn't say. And I'm not sure that I would write reviews that I wrote back then the same way about the same stuff.
We're probably about the same age. And I look back at my early writing. And I started the Nashville, Tennessee, and every now and then they'd let me write a review of something.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved shitting on stuff.
It's so much easier, right? It just flows. The shitting on, it just flows.
But something happened to me, and I can't tell you when or where or why or even how, where it stopped being fun. The joy of getting a book, looking for the shittiest part of it, dumping all over. Hearing a new album. I used to be a music reviewer at the Nashville, Tennessee.
Completely
qualified. I didn't know shit about shit, but I loved when bad CDs would come in and I would take some dump over a CD.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that was in me.
I mean, like I just said, I think if you're a critic, or, you know, I spent a lot of time recapping TV shows, and like bad shows that don't know that they're bad, it's just way easier, that you could just sort of, like, the jokes are easier to make. And that's what I felt like I was, quote, there for 25 years ago, was to make jokes, like to just MST3K, whatever, Dawson's Creek, Felicity, The Young Americans, whatever was on the WB, as we called it back then, Kids Ask Your Grandparents. That was the job as I saw it, and not necessarily to take a more Roger Ebertian approach to it and be like, you know, what is this document trying to do, versus just, you know, kicking it for the extra point, which when you're a younger writer slash person can feel more satisfying because it's less complicated and you're not... it's less nuanced, and it's just easier and faster, and you're on deadline and you come up with like a good comparison that, even if it's mean, like, you don't give a shit. You're 23 and you'll live forever, and, you know, fuck them if they can't take a joke. You get older and more nuance and gray creeps into everything, literally and figuratively. So yeah. I don't think we were bad people. I think we were just unformed people.
I think what I look back at with the most shame is I was actually a coward. Like, I would write bad things about people, and if someone ever reached out, I felt like hiding under my desk. And that's what I actually hate the most.
I don't know if I was a coward. I mean, I was starting when the internet was young enough that, like, sometimes it could be a little challenging for people to actually find me. Now I'm like basically the easiest person to find on the internet, or one of them. But I definitely regret the proportion of commentary that was devoted to people's appearance, because that's just not, like, that's not okay. That's not something people can help. Everyone was a victim of certain styles of the late 90s, like the scourge of the square neck tank top. It was a friend to few. So that I regret, but I probably also was a pussy. Let's not dress it up.
Wait, so in 1997, you started the site Tomato Nation. And I'm genuinely fascinated by this because I feel like a lot of listeners in this podcast are younger journalists who the quote unquote blogging era, it almost would be like the birth of like newsprint to people today. Mm-hmm. And even the term blogger sounds old.
Yeah.
What were you doing in 1997? Why did you start this site and what was even the purpose of it?
Because I couldn't get arrested in print. This is not going to be, I'll keep this short because, you know, poor me, whatever. Like I really did not struggle nearly as much as really anyone, but I graduated in 94. It was a recession, which felt like a big deal and there was nobody hiring, but like all these newspapers and magazines that you're like, oh, I think I saw a copy of that on eBay. Like they all still existed, but I had majored literally in creative writing. Like my senior thesis was a bunch of poems. Blah.
Where'd you go to college?
It's in New Jersey. Let's leave it at that. Every stereotype about the place is true. So yeah, do your worst.
Right.
But that recession was like a play school, like a Nerf recession compared to shit that happened 10 or 15 years later. So, but still, like I had not worked at the quote real newspaper at my college. I had worked at the alternative one that was always getting threatened with loss of funding because we were putting Tom of Finland catalog stills on the back, like a bunch of smarties. And so I moved back with my parents and I took a bunch of like archive jobs, like at my old high school. And I worked for some public television producers who happened to live next door to my parents. And I just waited for some secretary job at some publishing company to open up, which happened to be the German holding company that owned Scientific American at that time. The Scientific American archives are a fucking trip. If you ever have the chance, go get your archival gloves and go. They're fucking rad. And then I just like kind of waited for the internet to get not just common enough, but also lo-fi enough that I could figure out how to start a blog on SpryNet, which I did. And that was the birth of Tomato Nation. But it was just like, let's have some proof of concept of my humor writings in case I ever get a real job as a writer. And then I was sent to the Computer Expo in Vegas one year by the Scientific American team. I got stuck there in the blizzard of 96, I guess it was. And so I was just like sending email dispatches to my friends at work, writing about like, here's what it's like to live in the Dallas airport right now. And Adam Curry, yes, same one, had an internet concern. It was like, oh, she's funny. Let's give her a column. And like, it wasn't enough to live on. I still had to go be a records clerk at a college, but I could hang on. But it really was like, that was even possible, I think is not possible now, but you could just like have a blog and sort of hold on to it and be like, okay, if other bloggers link to me and then maybe some editor at quote, a real publication, which to us was print. Like, I think my mother still never quite believed that my job was real until I co-wrote a book with my working partner. So, and then she could go and see it at Barnes and Noble, but like, the whole blog, like web journal era is like, I haven't thought about this shit in a quarter of a century because it's completely immaterial. It's like completely divorced from the reality of the internet as it experienced now. So, but yeah, that was my story.
Again, like for people listening who weren't around during this era, it feels like outer space. Was the idea, in a sense, I'm going to start Tomato Nation, it'll be this blog, I can write as I want, I can show off what I can do, and some print publication will find me, swoop me up, and all of a sudden I'll be writing for the Washington Post?
Yeah. I mean, I think I had been on enough interviews at that point to understand that, like, what I was basically going to be offered was assistantships and that I should just take the first one no matter what publication it was for. But at that point, it was like, I don't... Like, my alternative paper jokes aside, like, the editors that were, you know, classes above me, they made sure that we could actually report, that we, like, understood basics of journalism and, like, reporting a story. So I could do that, but I was not especially good at it. I didn't have the stones for it, I don't think. I'm still not a very good interviewer, I wouldn't say. And, but it's like, you don't just get handed some like humor column. Like, I think I just wanted to, you know, roll, what's his face, Andy Rooney up in a rug and be like, I could do that. I'll just cut out all the swears. So what I was doing was forcing myself to stay on a schedule of writing what I did know how to write and like reviewing stuff and occasionally doing a listicle, like, here's my favorite books about movies and here's why. And sometimes going on a side rant about baseball. But yeah, I think the idea really was like that everything that was happening on the internet, at least until like, I'm going to say the early aughts, and for some people way past that, but in the late 90s, you really were just trying to put together clips, even if you just made the clips yourself, in case you tried out for a job and it was like, well, do you have any clips? Like, well, yes. And, you know, the URL has a bunch of like asterisks and ampersands in it, but it does exist.
It's like hard to fathom. When I was coming out of college, you'd apply to jobs and your clips would be literally
clips,
print out and clips.
Yeah.
Now a resume, write a cover letter, print it out. Mm-hmm. I would go to the local post office in Newark, Delaware with a stack of about 100.
Mm-hmm.
Dear Honolulu Advertiser, dear blah, 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 dear blah, 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 and mm-hmm. send them out and hope you hear back.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you have that? It was like this phone book size. It was like the publisher's index.
Editor and publisher, of course.
Yeah.
And you go through it. And I would lie. I'd be like, dear so-and-so, I have a cousin who lives in Honolulu and he sends me your paper and I love it. That is why I'm applying for a blank, blank, blank. It's amazing. I went 1 for 150 in job applications with that approach. The best part of Tomato Nation by far is the Vine, which is your advice column.
Oh God. And, yep.
Oh, come on. It's so good. I want to read one.
Oh no.
Okay. 2002. I have, you know, since you shit on my book, I feel like I'm allowed to at least do this, you know, and it's,
oh no. Okay.
It's a letter to you. Recently, I performed oral sex on my current boyfriend for the first time. He seemed to really, by the slight noises and body movements, enjoy it. And he says that he enjoyed it. The thing is, I went for a good half hour and he never came. I wondered if it could have been something I did or even didn't do. I asked him about it and he said it wasn't my fault. He didn't know what happened, but it just wouldn't happen for him. And now he won't let it go. Whenever the subject comes up, he goes on and on about how embarrassed he is and how he just can't understand what happened. I tried to console him and tell him it wasn't his fault. It's nothing he can help, but he just can't let it go. So I consulted a friend and he suggested I write you advice on how to handle the situation. Mystified. Dear Mystified.
Oh, no. Okay.
Well, you ask him why he keeps bringing it up, what he thinks happened. It's obviously bothering him. So maybe you should try to dig a little deeper and see why it's an issue for him. It's possible that the way you perform oral sex isn't quite what he likes, but he's scared to bring it up because he's shy about talking about that stuff or because he doesn't want to hurt your feelings. I mean, maybe it's that, but the anorgasmia could have come from about 1,000 other things. He's on an antidepressant for other drug that actually affects his ability to have an orgasm. He drank too much. He felt stressed about something else and couldn't relax. It happens sometimes to everyone. And unless it's a pattern with him, a one-time inability to reach climax isn't that big a deal. Talk to him. It's clearly an issue for you both. You should keep the lines of communication open in bed and out of it. First of all, that's actually a really good answer. I was expecting some like joke, joke, yuck, yuck. That was actually really good.
Actually, that I was going to say like, this doesn't sound like me. Like it actually doesn't sound like me. Occasionally I would have people guest on the column. So I was like, oh, that is good advice.
Well, you were getting a lot of letter, like a lot.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Advice. It was like 3 times a week. I ran that thing.
So how, I'm being serious. Like again, looking back, how do you explain that? Why were people writing you for advice?
I don't know. And I really don't remember how that started, that part of the column. But I think someone wrote in that was like, I had very strong, occasionally incorrect, but very deeply held feelings about certain grammatical and usage things. And I think someone wrote in about that. Like, it started as like a, well, what do I do about this? And, you know, in the event of a split infinitive. And so it started with that. And then people were like, oh, you know, by the way, I can't get my cat to stop going outside the litter box. Or it's like, what does Sarah know about? Cats doing dumb shit. Boys doing dumb shit. The English language doing dumb shit. Let's ask about that stuff. And then it started expanding with people being like, I have a, you know, triple wide foot size and I can't find the cool shoes I like. Can the Tomato Nation readers help me? So the Ask the Readers feature started and they were just like sourcing stuff for each other. It was pretty cool, actually. I kind of missed that one. But yeah, I think it was just... a changing of the guard in like agony aunt land at that time, generally in the culture, and people like I would run the whole letter and not cut it was another thing. So there was context that they, if they sent it into like Carolyn Hacks or whoever, that it would, or Dear Prudy, that it would get cut way down. And I think they felt better about that, if especially if there was like an audience of commenters that were chiming in about stuff. So right. I mean, but I was pretty upfront that I was like, I don't know shit about shit. I'm just bossy. Like, I'm just an Aries. Like, once I've given my advice, it's yours to do with what you want, including throw it in the garbage, which a lot of it you probably should, but occasionally I knew where to get good knee socks. Like, it wasn't totally worthless.
When I go to your website, the post that comes up was written on September 11th, 2019. It's called Who We Were. And you wrote, Sarah Bunting's past. I was 28, no grays. I had two cats, one gray. I lived for a moment in a loft in Toronto I was subletting from a college friend. The cats have gone. They are also here in simple cedar boxes that contain the gravel of their bones, because when the time came, I couldn't bring nothing home. The little Joe box sits on my desk near whatever I'm having to drink, because that's where he'd be. Fixing to knock it over, but he's gone. The college friend has gone too. A Caesar when he was alone. A sharp corner whose danger wasn't known. A grand procession to the cemetery. I was proud of that for him. It was something, the kind of something that's almost nothing, but something nonetheless. Something to keep him here. And every time I see a Molson tap in a pub, here he is again, clanking off the airporter with the straining duffel for the American miners. I was on Paxil. Lord, I hope that one's gone. It didn't do what it needed to. Just shrank down what I felt to a hallway, mild and medium. The sobbing I did 18 years ago today, I had not done for several seasons prior. Church giggles were like a story I'd read. One thing penetrated the white, noisy middleness, the worst possible thing. What the Paxil tried to treat is still here. I have anxiety disorder. I always have had it. It changes, that beast. It evolves. Hammering visible heartbeats, waves of despair, compulsions about foods and routes and lucky broken shotskas taken around everywhere. Agoraphobia, terror, and the war on it. Every day, we take in the same ground. The enemy never tires. At last and by accident, I found the right meds and the spirals still happen. But now they have an end, but they wait here for me. So freaking good. I open this by saying like, you shit on my book. At least you can fucking write. Like, you're like really, really good.
Thank you.
I know you've written a lot about September 11th. You write about it every year. Why?
Well, I mean, it started, you know, as I was like five blocks away when it happened. I wasn't even living in New York at that time. I would never have been in that part of town, even if I were. So the sort of journey to get out of Lower Manhattan and then to get to my parents' house from Manhattan that day, which usually would take 45 minutes, and that day it took 5 hours, and then to go back to Toronto and like crossing a border of any kind on September 12th, 2001 was like, oh, so this is what it's like to be like yanked out of a car, and they're like, you know, there's like a dog rattling around in my Honda. And then I finally got back to Toronto, and I wanted to just write down every single thing that I could remember from that day. And that, I mean, it, this again is something that they just like teach in school now, that my nephew, like it's in his American history unit at school, he's 14. But at the time, I think we sort of felt like this definitely was history and we should record everything. But, you know, the anniversaries were, like really a big deal and really still very close, especially if you were like continuing to live in New York City, that that day was just like, always out of the corner of your eye. That has been less and less true, of course, as time has gone on, like here in 2024. It does seem somewhat remote, but things sort of kept happening in my own life, like right around that time. And I just sort of felt like, okay, I don't really use this blog for much anymore, but I'm going to make sure the lights are always on here on that day, at least until the 20th anniversary, which of course has come and gone. But then my own mother passed like shortly after the 20th anniversary. And then I'm not sure why I'm still doing it, but there is something that is important for me. And I think other people who continue coming back to Tomato Nation on that day, that sometimes it's not really about that day. It's the door that that day can open to let you grieve other things, other people, to just sort of have a little bit more of a focus for what, especially in the last 5 years, I think has been an extremely disorienting time to live in. Just this feeling that like we're still falling and I don't know when we're going to land, if ever. The pandemic, like J6, everything that's gone on, I think sometimes people need they just need to not funnel it somewhere, but at least for me, to have the focus of not necessarily grieving the day, but to have a memoriam for anything each year on the same day, I think is helpful for me as a writer. And I think it's helpful for people who are still coming through after 20, 25 years to know that even if it's not directly about 9/11, that I'm still writing about loss, but also the things that we get to keep with us, which like Tomato Nation, I mean, established 1996.
On September 11th, I was driving through the city, heading to New Jersey, saw the hole in the building, saw the other plane coming, wrote extensively about all that stuff, right? And I didn't have any, a friend's son died, but oh, I didn't have God. Any. But I feel like one thing that goes like, it's almost been missed or something, is like for people of a certain age, maybe who think a certain way or have certain feelings about them, 9/11 feels like quicksand a little bit. And as it goes on, maybe you're the same way, because I definitely am this way. I kind of look around and I see people not really paying attention and people have kind of moved on and there's a new building. And my nephews were raised in New York City, but one was an infant and one was even born when it happened. They just view it as if I was viewing the Kennedy assassination. And I feel like screaming all the time, no, don't you understand? And I feel like fewer and fewer people listen as the time passes. And maybe for me, and maybe for someone like you, that's tough to grapple with.
Yeah, I don't feel like I know enough about how determinative that was politically, as far as like global politics and where we are today. Like I feel like it definitely was. I feel like there's a whatever probativity to it. Sometimes I just make up words. Hello. Yeah.
Sign of a good writer.
Sign of something. Yeah. But I just don't have the like political science language to say one way or the other about that. All I can sort of summon up is like, this was a singular moment. And what does it still have to teach us, like politics aside, or like historical tea leaf reading aside? Like, that's not my shop. You know, my shop is like, why, what has this been used for that it shouldn't have been used for? Like, you know, that's a matter of public record. But what can we take from this, like spiritually, emotionally, that might have some use, that might be instructive, that might be palliative?
Yep.
And I don't really think there's anything wrong with, like, whatever, 20-year-olds being like, oh, you know, that sepia tone shit, who cares? Like, this is how I felt about Zapruder and kind of still do. I mean, don't get me started on my crackpot Secret Service theories. But anyway, I get that could be frustrating, but that's not where I'm at with it. Are you talking about sort of like, we didn't learn anything from it politically and doomed to repeat, et cetera, or it's just like that the water's closing over it again?
Yeah, kind of. I just feel like, I'm not saying anyone's wrong at all.
Right.
I'm saying, in a way, I'm the one who like probably needs to move on. Like every September 11th, right. I just feel in a weird way, like increasingly alone, which is kind of weird to say because I didn't have anyone die. But I feel like as one who experienced it fairly closely, it just feels less and less of anything. It almost feels like, I used this example recently. I ran track at Delaware, the University of Delaware. And about 10 years after I ran, they killed the program. They ended the program. And you start wondering, did I even run track at Delaware? Did that even happen? And I feel like as 9/11 comes more and more distant and there's less and less attention paid to it, it just feels less tangible to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I also wonder, I mean, at the time, I sort of felt not grateful, but given the alternative that it was like, I feel like people who were not present and were not sort of standing on the corner of Wall and Broad looking at Tower 2 coming down and being like, well, there's no point running because I'm just going to be squashed like a bug. Clearly that didn't happen. But I think people had a little more trouble incorporating it and everything that came from it into their worldview if they hadn't directly experienced it. So I was always kind of glad that I was like literally on the ground at the time and was like, well, I heard the second plane go in. There's like famous footage from a French documentary team of like firefighters. Yeah. My brother is like 2 feet out of frame, like on the other corner in that shot. Like, you know, I felt like having actually been there, it was a little easier to cope in some ways, but I also, you know, I was living in Toronto at the time, but I was here in New York. And from my, like, I live at the end of the earth in Republican Brooklyn now, but like you go out on the back patio at the end of August and like they're still paying to have those lights at the site. And every year that they still do it, and I just like walk out front to like to take the dog out, and there they are. I have this, like, I make this little squeaking noise. I'm like so happy to see them. It's like, oh, it's my friends, the angels. So again, here, I don't think it's as far from mind. And like, I live where all the retired firefighters go when they're off the job. So like all the bars are named after obscure things that firefighters do. So it's a little different out here, but I mean, you're in LA, right?
I am.
So that's, I think there's a layer of, there's another veil between you and that experience in other cities, but I don't know.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman, and I'm here with my daughter, Casey, and what is that on your ankle?
It's a tattoo of a boot.
You got a tattoo of a boot on your ankle? Young lady, you're only 19 years old.
Dad, calm down. It's not just any boot.
I am so angry.
Dad, it's the kicking shoe worn by Garrett Lindholm, kicker for the 2011 Milwaukee Mustangs of the Arena Football League. I wanted to let people know they can go to royalretros.com and buy a hand-stitched, made-with-love Mustangs jersey.
Ugh, did you really have to get a tattoo to do this?
The butt piercing pavilion was closed.
March 27th, 2014, on refinery29.com, a writer named Kelsey Miller wrote a piece called Dawson's Rap, The Best Thing the Internet is About to Lose. And she wrote, earlier today, NBC Universal announced the shutdown of long-running sites Daily Candy and Television Without Pity. While both sites have loyal followings, the loss of Daily Candy came with the biggest surprise. But in my opinion, the greatest loss is Television Without Pity, or rather, Dawson's Rap. Before it existed in its current incarnation, before it was even Mighty Big TV, it began as a blog called Dawson's Rap. Founded in 1998 by Sarah D. Bunting, Tara Ariano, and David T. Cole, known by their avid readerships as SARS, Wing Chuck, and Glark, the blog was home to some of the most innovative humor on the web, devoted entirely to, quote, recaps, a new form of television criticism, which, if they didn't entirely invent, they certainly perfected. The writers recapped Dawson's Creek, then seen as a semi-scandalous teen drama on the WB network. While we early millennials all tuned in with desperate glee, the Dawson's Rap team cut right through the earnestness and Lilith Fair soundtrack, recognizing this show for the pubescent hormone hissy fit that it was. Bunting told the New York Times that the, quote, insidious, sexist, lazy writing had us apoplectic, not least because we're supposed to identify with a character who, on his best day, is an obnoxious, self-absorbed twit. On Dawson's Rap, she said much the same thing, but in a way that made me crack up so loudly, I was asked to leave the library. Okay. Why'd you write so much about Dawson's Creek?
Well, my working partner, Tara Ariano, and her husband, David T. Cole, like, we're still working together and we're still thinking about Dawson's Creek. We have a podcast called Again With This. We started with Beverly Hills 90210 and we're finishing up Melrose. Then we've moved on to Dawson's at the same time. But she and I met on a bulletin board. Remember those? Devoted to complaining about Beverly Hills 90210. And
I just want to say to listeners, not a literal bulletin board.
No, not a literal bulletin board. It was, I guess it was like a Discord.
Like a message room.
If you don't remember what a BB was, good.
Right.
Please alert the AARP. It was like a Discord, basically. But we started complaining at length about Dawson's Creek and how Dawson's Creek wanted to touch the hem of my so-called life's garment, but it could not. So a couple of our fellow citizens of this board were like, you guys should start your own recap site, possibly because they were sick of us choking off the blood supply of conversation with these complaints, possibly because they sincerely wanted us to be recapping the show. So we spun off to dawsonsrap.com. And then David T. Cole was like, well, there's no shortage of shittiest TV like this. Let's just launch a whole slate. So like the WB's entire lineup, we thought the West Wing was going to be some bullshit, like Rob Lowe working in the White House. LOL, we could carve that up. I mean, it was a very popular show for us, but, you know, it was actually good. Who knew? So that's how that started. But Dawson's Creek, I think it was really just an accident of like Tara and I happened to be on this bulletin board at the same time. Complaining about a show that wanted to be my so-called life and wasn't, because we were still grieving the loss of that one season wonder. But like watching it again now, it really is a time capsule, not just of how like lethally unfair we were to a lot of the actors and some of the writers, but also like, oh my God, like the scandalous thing that reviewer was talking about and the thing you just read was Pacey and Tamara, his teacher, like the kid is canonically 15. She's 40. Yeah. But on the show, it was like, ooh, scandal, like good for him, wink, wink. And now it's like, that's a felony. There is no consent there. And certainly we were not writing about it with the proper levels of opprobrium. I think we were just annoyed by his Hawaiian shirts more than anything. So it's been interesting to revisit. But yeah, Dawson's Creek, I think, is a sort of a symbol of a lot of other things that were bad. And speaking of like bringing it back around to go fuck yourself, as I love to do, one of these days, Vanderbeek and I are going to be in the same room and he's going to punch me in the face and I'm just going to have to take it because we talked so much shit about his five head and it was not okay. And I've got an eyeball flick coming and that's okay. I've made my
two things about Vanderbeek. Number one, my wife's least favorite actor. And number two, as a sports guy and a sports writer, his "I don't want your life" Texas accent in Varsity Blues. And the movie is actually enjoyable. I'm not saying it's a good movie.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's out of the theater.
You watch that shit nonstop. He's so not good in it.
Oh, like, no. He's not good at all.
Is he just, I hate to delve into this, but let's go back. Is he just not a good actor or does he need a good spot?
I mean, I haven't seen enough of his other stuff, really.
His canon. You haven't seen the Vanderbeek canon.
I don't want your life. That's like the second time that has come up today. So I don't know what that means. Goocher. Yeah, I think he's probably not great. And especially compared to some of the other people in that cast, like Michelle Williams.
Right.
Blowing everybody off the screen almost immediately. We weren't terribly kind to her either, but she was clearly the class of the jerk, like immediately. But he also, like, this character was just so Brandon Walshy and, like, self-righteous. And I think the writers thought that he was a lot more relatable and aspirational than he was when he sucked. And, yeah, he's bad. I will give Vanderbeek this, although I think he and his wife are, like, maybe anti-vax weirdos, which is not gonna work for me, but he did do that funnier die thing about like reenacting crying Dawson and like Dawson's O faces or something like 10 years ago. At least he's trying to have a sense of humor about himself. But yeah, I don't think he's good. I don't think this is like an overlooked genius.
Right. I always thought of him as the next Pacino, but you're saying maybe not.
No. Although I don't know. Do you hate Pacino? Because
yeah, right.
How does your wife feel about Pacino?
Well, I'm a very big fan of Pacino.
All right. Good, good.
All right. So as I said earlier, you and I about the same age. And again, we came up in this age of blogging. I used to have a blog. I had a website where I do a blog. And then one day I realized nobody's really feeling this anymore. And I stopped blogging. And you, in a way, like, you're a good person to talk to about sort of the adjustment, hitting a certain age that rhymes with schmifty, where you have to be, it's almost like, I always feel like it's a fight to maintain and it's a fight to survive. And as for me personally, you may not feel that way. I certainly do. You, tell me if I'm wrong, you co-host or host three different podcasts. Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs.
Yep.
That's not great.
Yep.
And with this, you have another one?
Quaid in Full. Every single thing Dennis Quaid ever did. We're on hiatus right now, but it exists.
Multiple podcasts. So yes. Multiple podcasts.
Too many.
You write Best Evidence about true crime, which was recently on Substack, but you changed platforms.
Yes.
What are you trying to do at this point in your career? What is the goal here?
I turned 50. Oh, Christ. Another one's coming. I turned 50 last year, almost a year ago. And I feel like I had much more of a, not like crisis, but like, what's the point of it all at 49? And then by the time 50 rolled around, it was like, oh, it's snowing outside. I'm just going to watch some Poker Face and knit with a cat on my lap, which that's the dream for me.
Sure you're not 70?
No, 50? Oh. I'm not sure. I have been not that slowly turning into my own grandfather for most of my life. Baseball books from the 40s, like Civil War factoids from Stones River. Like, what? Grandpa Buncey, why are you like this? I often have to remind myself at this point that I don't actually have to prove anything. Like, I'm no longer in the audition phase of my career. Like, maintain is a good verb that you just brought up. And I do, like, I work on these projects with people who I've, in some cases, been working with literally half my life. So I'm not going to quit these jobs, but there is a frequent reassessment. Like, you know, my working partner on the newsletter and I, when it was clear that we could not kind of stomach staying on Substack, we were like, well, I mean, should we just shut it down? Like, it doesn't make a ton of money, but is that the point of doing it? And do we have another option? It turns out we did. And we got to team up with another longtime colleague, which is great. But it's like the assessments at this point are much more like, why am I still sort of in like prove it mode? Mentally. And I think that part of it, it's just my personality. It's always like, imposter syndrome is real, but it's also like the ground has been shifting under writers, like always kind of, but it just seems to be like the gyre is speeding up since we got out of university. And I do not envy anyone graduating here in 2024 and being like, where shall my journalism degree and I go? Like, it's brutal. It's brutal out there. But yeah, like maintaining is important in terms of like giving your sort of working partners what they need. At least it is for me, that it's like, what are we all doing here? Is everybody getting what they need from this? But there's also, I don't know, like, you know, that expression where it's like, nobody ever put on their tombstone, like, I wish I'd worked more. And I'm like, no, I would.
I think about that all the time. I feel like whoever came up with that saying didn't enjoy what they did. Like, I love being a journalist. I love writing books. Mm. I love doing this podcast. I love this shit. Like, I don't need to, I'm not going to regret not taking more naps or not like walking the sun. I love this. I love the grind. I do. So I'm kind of like you in that regard. Yeah.
I mean, I like naps too, but it's like work.
That's because we're both over
work again. I think that it's balance is definitely important, but I also kind of feel like we are at an unfortunately very unique moment in like cultural history, literal history. And it's like, it's like my grandmother said, like, I could sleep when I'm dead. Like, she slept like 3 hours a day. Okay. Right. She's like, there's books to read. I was like, that's right. So, I think you and I are the same.
With the exception of me reading your shit down of my Mets book, what is the maddest you've ever had someone professionally at you in your career based on something you wrote or something you put out there?
Oh, boy. People would be like hurt more than mad. The only one I can think of offhand is an actor. I think it was him, an actor who was on Oz, pretty well-known guy, sent an email that was like, wow, you really are mean. And I've kept it all these years because I actually really liked the guy's work. I thought he played McManus on Oz. His name is Terry Kinney. I always liked his work. I thought he was cast well in that role. That character was a twat. You're doing your job. I didn't recap Oz. Like, I have no idea what he was even talking about, but he sent this email, you really are mean. And I was like, I mean, yeah, I guess, but I've kept it ever since because it's like he was right, but also like completely nonspecific, and I'm not totally sure that he meant me. Who can say? I'm sure there are other examples. Like, there was this, you know, legendary dust up with Aaron Sorkin, like picking a very obvious nom de boards and wading into our forums on Television Without Pity, and like that a PA was assigned to basically take his laptop away because He was getting in fights with people. And then he basically wrote us into an episode and said that we all lived in our mom's basements and we're fat and smoke parliaments. And I was like, bitch, it's Camel Lights. Get it right. But I don't think he was mad.
And my mom's basement is furnished.
Yeah. No. Excuse me. That is a code. That window is up to code. How dare you? Yeah, that was like, that was a big whoop for us. Like, I don't think he was even mad and it put us on the map. So, so that was great. But, yeah, I mean, you know, people get mad and you're aware after a while that it's a pitfall, but it's also kind of like, I feel like I'm at a point now where it's like, if people need to get mad, that's okay. But I don't feel that I've taken the like cheap, shitty shots that I used to take back in the day. So, yeah, you know, Vanderbeek, you, the Go Fuck Yourself Club is hereby adjourned. I hope.
You know what, Sarah, my goal in life was to be in a club with Vanderbeek. So this actually is the fruition of a dream.
We are living the dream. Thank you so much for having me on.
You know what I'm going to do now is go put whipped cream on my wife's body, just like Vanderbeek and Varsity Blues. And then I'm going to go give Billy Bob a bunch of beers and we're going to go hang out in this truck.
Finally, Jesus.
Sincerely, Sarah, first of all, thank you for doing this. Second of all, I just love like talking to people who at some point I was slightly annoyed or angered at, but didn't know. And they're just people and the whole thing. And like, you're a wonderful writer. And yeah, I appreciate you doing this.
Oh, sincerely. Thank you. I do have my moments. Thank you for letting me come on so that we could work through this. And I'm sorry about winning time. That's bullshit.
You know what?
It's a good show.
You know what, Sarah? Nobody wants to hear a person complain about only having two seasons of an HBO show. You know?
Yeah, probably.
I want to thank today's guest, Sarah D. Bunting, for joining me on Two Writers Singing Yang. You can follow Sarah on Instagram at Sarah D. Bunting and visit Tomato Nation for tons of her best stuff. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Singing Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.